He kōna e ipurangi tēnei nā te reo irirangi o Aotearoa.
Nō mai, haere mai. Thanks for joining us on Country Life. I'm Carol Stiles. Today we're visiting a small but proud wine-growing region. An Aussie innovation is helping fish in the Rangitata River stay on their journey. And we chat with a youth ag leader. But first, our guest today will wish RNZ visits more often. His farming district is in the grips of a drought. But since the interview on Tuesday, the skies have opened. It won't be enough to fully replenish soil moisture, though, but it's a help. The farm is in eastern Waikato, and the farmer estimates this year's dry has cost $100,000 in lost milk production.
Oh, that's dry. Look at that, just dust. Nothing from the surface down, just a little bit of rain, that drizzle that we had last night, and that's just pure dusty dirt. My name's Peter Leheran. I farm at Tepeninga near Morrinsville. I'm a Tatua supplier. Been on the farm since 1977, so 46 years of dairy farming on the land here. The farm has basically got three soil types, basically a Waihau sandy loam, a Waitoa clay, and a Tepeninga series. Some of the best soils around in the world, really, in this very district that we live in. Milk 210 Holstein Friesian cows, although I don't milk them now. I've given up milking cows. I think I'm old enough to retire in that way. And we do pretty good production here, but with this drought we're having at the moment, we're down 9.3% in terms of production. And the Tatua payout, it's quite significant. It's really our profit, which we then pay our tax with and our living and all the rest of it. We definitely need some rainfall, some serious rain. Gentle and slow for the beginning would be ideal. Rainfall, we've had 3 mils this last month. The month before we had 30 mils. We just did a dig down on the ground down here and the soil is just dust on this beautiful loamy soil. How we're coping? Well, we've just had a load of, you just heard it over there, a truck emptying out some brewer's grain, just a trailer load. It's quite hard to get. And we also feed maize silage that we grew on the farm and at my maize block down the road. So we put in 200 tonne. We've fed 80 tonne already. Normally we would only be feeding probably 40 tonne at this stage, but we're so dry. Cows are going into fresh air, really. The grass is green. It's just little shoots in the ground, but unless we get some serious rain, the cows are really eating nothing. We haven't undersowed any pastures yet because the lack of rainfall means it will germinate, but it may actually die just due to lack of moisture. It's interesting, I've got heifers grazing down at Pew Pew, and he's in the farm owner is in exactly the same position. Most farmers in our greater Waikato will be suffering too. A drought normally ends middle of March, April, but this drought has carried on. It reminds me of 1983 when I was putting in underground drainage. We were really dry. No rain occurred until early June. We couldn't get culls away, which is similar to at the moment. There's a waiting list, but back then the works were on strike because the unions were quite big back then. And you couldn't buy any food because we had such a terrible spring back in that year. So, yeah, it's similar. We had a good spring. Cows peaked where they should, but end of November we were just dry.
Ideally, what would you like to receive in the way of rain over the next few weeks?
10 mils a night would be absolutely ideal. Rain at night, fine by day. That way we would grow grass during the daytime. The soil temperatures at the moment are 17 degrees. Anything above 14, we will grow good grass. We just need sunlight and moisture and soil temperatures. If it gets cold, we will get frosts. We've had 2 frosts so far last week, but they haven't affected the soil temperature, obviously, because those days ended up being 17, 18 degrees afterwards. We do grow grass here all year round, but it's minimal during the winter. So it's serious. It is really serious for the Waikato.
Peter Leheran talking to Andrew McRae. Peter's had 43 millimetres of rain. He says he needs at least 130. This week, MPI classified drought conditions in Waikato and South Auckland as a medium-scale adverse event. Now here's Duncan Smith with the regional wrap.
Kia ora. In the far north, farmers around Kaitaia and Broadwood were thrilled when the skies opened this week and delivered 60 to 70 millimetres of rain. The east coast had about 20, but it's sitting pretty with plenty of grass. The schedule for bulls looks good for the time of year. It's about $6 a kilogram. Space at the works is still tight for cows. Lots are coming up from the Waikato, taking the slots local farmers would typically use. Pukekohe has had some magic rain, 36 millimetres by Friday morning. This week, four young growers have been vying for the title of Pukekohe Young Grower of the Year. The finalists, two women and two men, have to complete a range of theoretical and practical activities, give a speech and take part in a quiz. Good luck to them all.
A Waikato kiwifruit grower has been irrigating his gold vines every second week for the past 2 months because he wants to keep his vines alive. In 40 years of growing, he's never seen it as dry in May. The soil moisture probe is showing this month is as dry as a typical February. Vines that accidentally missed the water started losing leaves early from stress. He says competing packhouses have been helping out packing each other's fruit to cope with labour shortages. Meanwhile, on Thursday, 60 millimetres of good soaking rain fell near Hamilton. North King Country has had perfect weather, warm and about 100 millimetres of rain over 5 days. It means the flats are growing grass and the hills are greening up. Pasture covers there are a lot shorter than normal. Farmers are struggling to source fertiliser. There's been high demand because some companies have said they'll hold prices until the end of May, and you also can't count on ships arriving on time.
It was an absolutely rotten day in Taranaki when we called. Ominously dark, wet and horribly windy. But earlier in the week, good warm rain finally arrived and we're told there have been some pretty jumpy growth rates. The rains come in the nick of time. Cows are being dried off 5 to 7 days earlier than normal due to the sluggish growth and a fear of eating too far into winter's supplementary feed. Farmers can't complain though, the payout's good. Gisborne's had a mild week after pretty hot temperatures. An ag consultant says the region's farmers have zero problems going into winter compared with their contemporaries in other parts of the country. Grass is still growing well. Farmers are still dealing with the aftermath of the March and April storms, though. They're cleaning up and repairing fences whenever they have a spare moment, and are still getting rid of logs and debris in paddocks. It'll be 6 months until they can get back to where they were before the storms. Gisborne's mandarins, navel oranges, kiwifruit and persimmons are being harvested.
Hawke's Bay had a sunshine-filled Friday morning, but a good strong westerly was ripping through as well. Between 20 and 60 millimetres fell across the district and temperatures are still mild. Our farmer says it's the best autumn in living memory. Everything is growing well. A Rangitike farmer says they've had an amazing week with a couple of days of big rains broken up with nice, sunny, warm ones. He's been able to get a lot done and watch the grass grow at the same time. He's mainly been fencing and gorse spraying.
It had been getting a bit dry in Wairarapa, so this week's good rain has kicked things into gear again. Most sheep and beef farmers are winding down after the rams have come out. It's been a really good autumn in the region, and there's plenty of feed. The dairy guys are drying off and a few ducks are being shot, although they are a bit thin on the ground, apparently. It's still difficult to get lambs into the works. And on Friday morning, hail and a tornado in Levin has wrought havoc on the huge market gardens there. Woodhaven Gardens director Jay Clark says it's the worst hail damage they've seen in 44 years of growing in the district. He says it looks like someone has taken a machine gun to his crops. Crops planted in autumn are meant to last into October and November, and some of them are completely gone.
Across Cook Strait, and it's rained in the Tasman region, which has helped some grass growth, especially after rain last week as well. However, now the temperatures are quite cold, so there's not likely to be time for much pasture recovery. Farms are going into winter tight on feed, although it's not quite so short around Murchison. There's still an issue getting cull cows off farm. As a result, lots of them are being sold cheaply to Canterbury farmers who do have grass. They'll fatten them over winter and then sell them. Winter is on its way in Marlborough. If you can't see snow, you can certainly feel it's in the air. Scanning on early lambing ewes has started, so those results will be coming out over the next month. Between 10 and 25 millimetres of rain fell region-wide this week. Inland on Molesworth Station, snow fell on Thursday night, but recently the weather's been good, so the farm's well prepared with plenty of feed for stock.
The west coast has had a lot of rain, but it's still warm. The farmer we spoke to was only wearing a jacket because it was wet. Grass is still growing really well, and now it's a matter of picking a good spell of weather for drying the cows off, which he thought would arrive early this coming week. Some dairy farmers have dried off herds already. North Canterbury is looking pretty good. It had been dry up to the start of May, but the past 2 weeks have seen good rainfall and autumn growths kicked along. The majority of farms will be pushing good feed levels into winter, better than average. Stock are in good condition. As farmers have completed their winter budgets, many can see they have enough feed on farms to be comfortable buying in store lambs and cattle. They're buying on the strength of good-looking schedules for spring. Although our consultant contact said some are still more conservative and despite great amounts of grass won't buy stock in case the meatworks backlogs don't clear. He also said those buying in stock used to hunt all over the South Island for them, but now with the price of fuel, they only look closer to home.
Until Thursday, South Otago had had a warm week with 16 and 17 degree days, but then a cold snap whipped through and snow fell on the hills. Farmers say May makes or breaks winter for them, and until now, it's made winter. Grass growth in the past 2 weeks has been better than in the past 2 months. Southland received lashings of rain on Thursday night. One farmer tipped 20 millimetres out of his rain gauge, more than his farm received for all of March. And like South Otago, the growth in the past 2 weeks has been terrific, letting previously drought-hit properties catch up a bit.
You're listening to Country Life on RNZ National, 101 FM.
Coming up shortly, we're checking out our sophisticated and costly fish screen and later talking about Northland wines. But first, a new organisation's been established to give young people a say in the ag sector. It's called the Food and Fibre Youth Network, and Tuhoi and Ngātiawa descendant Cheyenne Wilson is its first chairperson.
We are aiming to be a pan-sector youth voice. It's available for industry bodies, organisations and government to approach to get that youth voice at the table when decisions are being made and discussions are happening.
And what's your background and how did this opportunity to lead the network come about?
So I grew up in Southland and moved to Canterbury about 8 years ago, and I've been dairy farming for a few years now. And 3 years ago, actually, decided to go and study at Lincoln University. And I guess when I moved up to Canterbury, I didn't really know anyone. And I got along to my local Young Farmers Club, as you do, and jumped right into leadership there and sort of, made my way, I guess, through the leadership pathway within Young Farmers through club level and then onto a regional level as well. And when I saw that they were advertising roles on the the council, I thought it was a great opportunity to help lead that youth voice in the sector. So I put my hand up.
So what are your goals? What would you like to achieve in this leadership role?
I guess for myself, like personally, I just want to encourage young people and our rangatahi to put themselves out there. That's been, I guess, the most rewarding thing for me is being able to push myself outside my comfort zone and be rewarded for it. And I really want to see our rangatahi do the same. So if I can, influence just one person to put themselves forward, it would be, for leadership roles, it'd be really awesome. And then, I guess, collectively with my counsellors, alongside me, we just really want to make sure that, that our voice is being heard and that we are being approached to be part of discussions when they are happening. Yeah. Mm.
What other organisations are you involved with? Are you talking to?
Well, we're hoping to talk to ministers. We're just organising a meeting with the primary industries ministers at the moment So hoping to get in front of them in June, but also just trying to get, I guess, build our network as well, our network members, to make sure that we do get a really nice collective voice across the sector. There's some sectors that we still need to tap into, and probably some regions as well. So we're working on that, which is really cool. And yeah, we're getting approached now by industry. Federated Farmers have approached us to speak on a panel at the Primary Industry Summit in July. So those sort of opportunities are coming up, along with, you know, Seafood NZ and their conference as well. They've asked us to speak there on a panel. So yeah, it's really cool that these organisations are reaching out to us and recognising us, and we want to keep building on that.
Yes. And Cheyenne, is this a long-term role for you? What are your future plans?
Yeah, I guess I haven't thought too much about it at this stage. I wouldn't think it would be too long-term. I mean, I'm close enough to 30 that I'm not sure how much longer I'll be considered a youth. But at this stage, I'm really just concentrating on the impact that I can have while I'm in the role. But definitely aware that I do have to step aside and allow for a more youthful and vibrant voice to come through and develop our leaders as well. You can't sit in, you know, leadership roles forever. You've got to allow other people opportunities.
Food and Fibre Youth Network Chair Cheyenne Wilson.
Now we're heading to Klondike, near the foothills of the Southern Alps in mid-Canterbury. This is where water is diverted from the Rangitata River for the Rangitata Diversion Race, or RDR, a combined irrigation and power generation scheme. Cosmo's there to see a new state-of-the-art fish screen before it goes underwater. He's with RDR Management CEO Tony McCormick.
We're just below the Rangitata Gorge. We have the Rangitata Diversion Race intake. So this, just a kilometre and a half up from where we are right now, we have our intake, and we divert water from the Rangitata River into the canal. A lot of water, you know, 30 cumex is a lot of water. And that water goes right across the Mid-Canterbury Plains and supplies most of the irrigation through the plains here. When it's not being used for irrigation, there's a power station at the end which will run. So we're a multi-use. We run 365 days of the year. And quite frankly, the RDR is the lifeblood of Mid-Canterbury.
Now, I have come up here today because you have built a massive fish screen.
Yep, we've been a year building this facility, which, as you say, Cosmo, is huge. I sort of challenge most people when they first arrive to say, what are you looking at? Because it looks like anything but a fish screen. It's certainly the biggest facility of its kind in New Zealand, and we sort of think probably in the top 10 in the world. And the whole idea of this facility is to keep the fish in the river. And because we divert a significant proportion of the river a lot of the time, we bring in a lot of those fish come into the canal. So this facility is located as close as we could get it to the intake. And with these screens that you can see, we can put all our water through the screen and the fish stay on this side, and there's a channel that returns them back to the river. So we're getting them back to the river as quickly as we can and as safely as we can.
Yes. What sort of fish are you targeting?
All fish, for sure. It's designed and will, I'm sure, help protect both the sports fishery, which is the salmon and trout, mainly salmon, and the native fish, of which there's a variety of species, including the large eels that might have gone up and then are migrating, doing their final migration, whereas the salmon, of course, are doing their first migration. So we get juvenile salmon coming down, and they've been the trigger species, I guess, that have initiated this, the concern by anglers and the community about the demise of the salmon fishery in a lot of rivers, but the Rangitata has not been spared from that. So I call them the trigger species. They're also our sort of target design species. They're the hardest one to design for, so those are the ones that we have designed. You'll see the 2 millimetre gap in our screens and what have you. So all fish species, but I'd have to say the salmon have been the driver.
Once the fish get into this system, how far is it before they end up back in the river? How long does it take?
I'm not sure of that maths, but if they just go with the flow, they're only going to be passing through this facility in less than 2 minutes. especially the small ones that don't really have the ability to sort of, you know, swim against current, what have you, but larger fish, and the natives tend to be a bit more inquisitive and they like to just hang around, so, you know, they're not getting into the race and they're not being lost from their habitat. But eventually I think everyone will be on their way and back to the river. So yes, it's only really a matter of minutes.
And then back on their journey.
Yep, back to the river. And unlike the original screen, or the one this is replacing, which is an interesting technology, it's a behavioural screen that creates a bubble curtain across the canal. And the idea was the fish were deterred by that and diverted into the offtake. But that would still let some fish through. This will let no fish through.
One of the steel fish screens is raised above an empty concrete water channel. The screen's big enough to stand in, and its nose is coned like a missile, so water can flow smoothly around it.
We have seven screens, that's seven of these cylindrical T-screens, they're called. The screens are a cylinder, which is a very efficient way of getting a lot of screen area in a short distance. They have brushes, they have fixed brushes, and the cylinder rotates against a fixed brush to keep the screens clean and take the debris off them. It's up in the maintenance position. It's right beside us. We're standing on the walkway, but they'll only be up here on occasion if we needed to do some maintenance, and we expect that'll be very rare. But without the water in it, it's the only time you're going to get from now on to ever walk through this facility and get right up close to them. So,
yes.
Yeah.
So how long are these cylinders?
We're about 80 metres long with the cylinders. Then we've got a further 26 metres of flat screen, because as you can see standing here, the whole channel narrows as we come through the facility. And what we're doing there, as the water passes through the screens, we're trying to push the fish and the sediment down the facility and out the exit back to the river.
So when will the water be diverted through this system?
4 weeks from today, these will all be underwater. Yeah, we've got a very busy period now, because this is located, we've been able to build this offline, so the canal is just beside us here. It's about 20 metres away at this location. So next Monday we turn the water off, we shut down the scheme completely, which is quite a rare occasion, and busy with earthworks to cut through this last bit, what we call a plug at the top. You'll see when we walk up, it's very obvious, so that we've got to connect it at the top, let the water in, and we've got to connect it at the bottom to let the water out. We'll fill in the old canal, and this then becomes part of the new canal.
Now this has cost nearly $18 million yes. to construct. Where does the money come from?
The people that use the water, so predominantly farmers. We have four shareholders. We've got two irrigation companies, Trustpower, because they own the power stations, and they, as it turns out, tend to be the predominant user. They use between 50 and 60% of the water on an annual basis, because in the winter they're just taking all the water for generation. And the council, we supply stock water, and they've all contributed to this cost. So yes, there's no government money or anything. It's all user pays. You know, the privilege of taking water comes at an expense.
Gosh, and it's all for the fish.
It is. Yep, it is targeted, you know, solely at protecting the fishery. And yeah, it's what we need to do to be able to continue to take water from the river and have the privilege of taking and using that water.
Has everything gone to plan?
The build has gone incredibly well. The earthworks, the concrete construction has been amazing. We opted to go a lot of precast. You see all these big panels, they're all constructed in Christchurch and trucked down. So our original program was to be completing this before the irrigation season, but the design, we spent a lot more time than we'd intended just making sure that the design was right, especially hydraulics. But the contractors haven't sat back on that. They got stuck in and did a fantastic job.
Are we going any down below with the slide gate open still? We could go inside.
Now, you've got a team of Australians here because they are the ones that designed and built the fish screen.
Yeah, the main components, the real shiny bits, I tend to call them, were built in Victoria in Australia by AWMA.
So this is Craig and Tim.
What are you doing here today?
Oh, basically just running through, obviously with the COVID, we haven't been able to get over and look at the site with water going on site next week, is it?
Well, we start the cut over next week.
Really desperately wanted to see the equipment before it got wet, you know, make sure we can make any minor changes or modifications while we can.
What were your first impressions coming up here?
Oh, wow, you know, excellent. Yeah, it's very impressive. Yeah, we've seen lots of photos, but to see it in real is quite a sight.
This must be quite an achievement for you.
Yeah, yes. So it's not the first project I've been involved with, but certainly a very exciting one and huge for us. Proportionally to our sort of budget and everything else, this is huge. The cost of this, you asked earlier about who pays. The cost of this facility has doubled our annual charges to all of our customers, so it's hugely significant.
Now we are heading down to the base of the screen, which is about, 5 metres under the steel platform.
So this is who we should talk to, Brett, standing with his arms folded.
Brett Kelly is Managing Director of the Australian business that has built the fish screens. After all the COVID travel delays, he's pleased to finally be here.
It's great making them, it's great testing them at the factory, but it doesn't ever compare to coming to site and seeing them all installed in their full array. It's very impressive.
Yes. How challenging has it been for you to design and build this fish screen system?
This is one of the biggest fish screen systems of its type in the world. So from that point of view, it was a pretty big task, but it's all come together pretty well. So
yes,
we didn't have an opportunity to come over here for, what's the last time, was it 12 months ago? Or
it was
another job we came over for. So yeah, it was 2 years. It's been over 2 years since we've been here on site. So last time I came, there was nothing here, and now it's basically all finished.
Tony was saying that a lot of this was engineered and built in Australia.
All of it was engineered and built in Australia.
And
assembled. Yeah, we didn't supply the concrete and the steel. It's all been designed and built over there and shipped over. Yeah.
So I guess this has been all about collaborating with different teams to pull it together.
Yeah, because it's been very, very important that when we're operating out of Australia and we're doing a project over here in New Zealand, a lot of stuff doesn't have precedent, so it's not just a matter of saying we're doing the same thing over and over again and everyone knows what they're doing. There's a lot of new stuff here. So to do that, we need a really good partnership between everyone, and we've certainly had that. It's been a great project to work on.
We head down to the concrete floor of the construction site that will be permanently submerged in water once the fish screens are lowered.
You can see what looks like a canal, and it will be the canal coming into the facility. And up right through there is the canal with the water in. So we've got to take out that plug of material
and bring
the water in here. That sounds easy.
And it will all go through the cylinders.
Yep. I use the term percolate because it is really low velocity as it comes through, because that's the whole concept, I guess. We get the fish won't be drawn to the screens or stuck on the screens with the water coming through it, so it comes through very slowly and there's a strong sweep flow through the facility to keep them going.
So in theory the fish won't be harmed at all as they pass through?
No. You can see how wide it is here. I mean, most of them won't even interact with the screen. So yeah, I'm 100% confident fish won't get through, and very confident they won't get harmed.
There must be two of the key objectives.
Yep, our consent has conditions that specify velocity, very low velocity through the screen. Very complex to measure all the velocities, water velocities through this facility. And then testing that the fish are not harmed is going to be very challenging too. We're still refining that process, so we somehow need to capture fish that have come through the facility, and we'll be doing close examinations for fin damage and that sort of thing. We'll be doing that using test fish. We'll release fish and then capture them so that we know the condition of them when we release them. So, imagine releasing 500 fish here and then trying to capture as many as we can. I'm not concerned about capturing them all. We just need to capture enough to say this is a good sample.
And will you be working with Fish and Game?
Yep. They've been a great support. And the anglers who... sort of initiated this with their discontent, I guess, with what we had before in the salmon fishery. So they've all been with us on the journey, and right now, as we're trying to refine this fish capture, very involved with us. So, it always surprises me how little is known when you really need to know it about what fish want and how they behave, especially these young juveniles. They continue to be a little bit of a mystery of just how they behave. But I think the technology we've adopted here will deal with all those issues.
Tony McCormick from Rangitata Diversion Race Management. Cosmo was also talking to Brett Kelly and Craig Ross from Orma Water Control Solutions. To see some photos of the impressive fish screen that Tony says has just gone underwater, go to the Country Life webpage.
Hi, I'm Andy Gunson. I'm a sheep milker from Hawke's Bay. You're listening to Country Life on RNZ National.
Northland may produce just a tiny fraction of New Zealand's wines, but it's a proud and expanding grape-growing region. And it's the home of New Zealand wine. Rod McIver, owner of Marsden Estate and the driving force behind Northland's wine industry, says New Zealand's first grapes were planted at Kerikeri's stone store in 1819 by Samuel Marsden.
It's reported that they were planted next to the goat paddock, so they didn't survive that long. There would have been other plantings around the area, but they weren't recorded. And then, of course, the next one was Busby down at Waitangi, and that was recorded, and wine was made, and there were comments on the quality of that wine.
Ah, and what was it like?
It was a light, sparkling white wine, and the Waitangi Trust have actually contacted us, and they would like to reenact that and plant a little block and make the same sort of wine again. So it would have been a light, early drinking, probably a little bit sweet, drinking style wine, but basically just crushed juice and started to ferment.
And what's happened since in Northland?
Well, it's been a long, slow journey over those 200 years, and I think it reflects probably what's happened in New Zealand. It probably wasn't until the 60s that we started to make quality wines. And Northland was probably left behind. It was started in West Auckland, and then, of course, the success in Hawke's Bay and then down to Marlborough, which is driven by Savvy, and that still continues. So when we planted in the early 90s, there were only two wineries up here, and it wasn't considered an area to grow grapes, as Central Otago wasn't or Marlborough wasn't before they planted.
What wineries were here when you arrived?
There were two, Longview, which was started by Mario Volatich's father in the 60s, and Okahu, which was started by Monty in the 80s.
It was 1984 when Monty Knight planted his first vines near Kaitaia. He's helped put Northland wine on the map. He grew the first Syrah in the country to win a gold medal.
Well, yes, people would look at me and I'd say, I'm going to plant a vineyard in the far north, and I'd smile and say, oh, well, good luck for that. One of the great winemakers said to me, Monty, you'd be better to go out the back of your property and dig a big hole and start throwing money into it. It'd be cheaper. And another one said, you buy a lot of wine off us. Why don't you just save the money and buy all the nice wines you like and drink them? But I decided I wanted to try and make wine. And John Buck said to me at one stage when I wrote for some advice from him, he said, Monty, given good grapes, red wine practically makes itself.
What had happened in this area before? The Dalmatians made wine, didn't they?
Lots of Dalmatians, who were Croatians actually, but they came from the coast of Dalmatia. And they lived mainly in the far north, where they were digging gum in the gum fields. And most of them brought with them that European culture of having a little back shed out the back where you made your own wine and you kept a couple of barrels. And they brought that culture with them to New Zealand. Now, several of those people, Kumeu River, the Brakoviches, the Solyans, a number of famous names in winemaking now, Noblos, came from the far north. But they went to Auckland and planted vineyards mainly out at Kumeu area because that's where the market was. There was more people that you could sell your wine to.
Monty says time has shown it's possible to grow very good grapes in Northland.
If you grow rubbishy grapes or rotten grapes or not properly ripe grapes, you won't make good wine. You've just got to look after them, and then every 1 or 2 years you'll have a really good crop. Sometimes you'll have failure and disaster, just like potato growers or kumara growers or anybody else. There's no magic formula except just do it well. And we're warm, so you can grow a lot of those warm varieties better here than you can in the South Island. One of the problems we've had here is humidity, and the spray program's a bit more extensive because our humidity encourages mould and fungus and bugs, so you've got to deal with those. But there are lovely, friendly sprays now. It's so much better than when we first started.
He says Northland wines have a distinctive taste reflecting the climate, soil and terrain.
his vineyard has its own characteristics.
When you take Kauri gum and you mix it with sand that's been blown up out of the off the 90 Mile Beach and out of the ocean, and it gets hard, and you combine gum with it, and it turns into a stone called sandstone. And it's, you know, you can hit it with a crowbar and sparks come off it. So to plant a vineyard in it, you've got to break through that so that it gets some drainage going, so it's really good. And then you get below it, and here's the Kauri Forest. Look, it's all it's like digging up a compost heap. This beautiful, yummy, you know, flavoursome earth that grows can grow things, but you've got to get through all this to get to it.
You're showing me a test tube of the soil.
The layers. Yeah,
yeah, the layers of the
and
soil.
And then finally you get to clay. So a lot of the world's great red wines are grown on clay. Do you want to try some wine? You have a little try. And these are both Syrah. So this is our gold medal Syrah. And this is one from a not-so-good vintage, but still pleasant. So maybe this one will be nicer.
Northland now has more than 40 growers, and Rod McIver says many of those are growing wine for themselves and sell the excess.
So they'll bring the grapes to us and then we'll process them and then they'll take that wine back at the end of it. You can get quite a lot of wine off a very small area. And we've got clients that have got less than a hectare and they probably return $30,000 off that by being able to turn it into wine and then direct selling it.
So how many people are you making wine for?
Between 30 and 40, I think. So we've probably got over 100 different individual batches of wine.
Oh, that's hard to keep track of.
No, if you do it properly, everything has to be written down. if the masking tape came off, we'd be in trouble.
In all, Northland grows less than 100 hectares of grapes. Three vineyards are about 12 hectares in size. Half a dozen are 3 to 4 hectares, and there are many smaller growers, some with just half a hectare planted.
So it's basically a bit like Central Otago, where you buy a block of land, you see your neighbours growing grapes and you think that's a good idea. So they've gone ahead and planted. People don't realise how much fruit you get off a very small block. So if you're looking at the spacings we have, it's about 5 bottles per vine. So in the 1,650 to a hectare. So you can actually get quite a lot of wine off a very small area. So I came here to grow oranges. And I had a vision of sitting in a hammock watching these oranges grow, and then you take them off to market and live happily ever after. But unfortunately, it's very hard to make a living off most horticultural products. We then got into kiwi fruit, but the attraction from wine was the fact that you've got a product that you can grow and then sell, so you can value add all the way through. Plus, it has a shelf life. So it's not like kiwi fruit where you have to get rid of it over a 3 or 4 month period. So we figured if we could have a venue where we could sell the wine direct to the public, and because of the success of the other wineries that were up here, we felt we could go ahead and do it, and we have.
The landing on the Purirua Peninsula, half an hour from Kerikeri, is one of Northland's bigger vineyards and has recently built its own winery on site. Its director, Peter Jones, says so far the landing's put 10 vintages in the bottle. The first 8 were made by Rod.
So we'd truck it in down the dusty road and Rod would work his magic. So it's a very small and collegiate group of growers here. We all look after each other fairly well.
We're all one brand. So we have 3 workshops a year with viticulture to make sure that everything's up to speed and everyone knows what they're doing. And we do the same thing with the wines. So we're trying to get consistency and lift the profile and the quality of the wines, because it doesn't take too many bad wines to spoil the whole brand. So we do work very closely together, and it's a great group. And part of the reason you do this is it's fun.
When you get together, I would imagine there's a few samplings that take place.
Quality control.
Yeah, it's probably better than a potato tasting.
Rod says 0.02% of New Zealand's total wine production comes out of Northland.
So we're a very small part of the wine industry, but I think we're a very important part because we get a lot of tourists here, and their exposure to the wine here will influence what they think of New Zealand wines.
Do many of the labels export
their wine?
No, very few. We are now exporting to the US, but I think we were probably the only one. Right now, maybe Longview sending wines to China still. Very little of our wine even gets exported to Auckland. Not a lot of it makes it over the Brenda, and so a lot of it is purchased at the cellar doors here in Northland. So there is probably only maybe three or four labels that you'll find elsewhere in the country.
The Landings wines are being marketed in Orange County, California, and Peter says sales volumes are good.
One of our people is walking from restaurant to restaurant now with our wine and telling the story of Northland and getting very, very good response. I think the idea of a wine from New Zealand which is not a Marlborough Sauvignon Blanc or is not a Pinot Noir actually really piques people's interest over there. But for them to be able to discover a wine from a faraway country and a small part of that faraway country that has an incredible backstory to it, they really relate to that. And they're much less price sensitive over there as well, which is handy.
They're willing to pay the big bucks.
You should be marketing.
That's the executive summary. Well, we took two tiers of wine over there, two different labels at two different price points, and the most expensive one sells every time.
Grapes are grown in Northland from Mangawhai in the south to north of Kaitaia, a distance that spans more than 200 kilometres. There are inland blocks and coastal blocks, which, even if they grow the same variety, produce wines with differing flavour profiles. Vines grow particularly vigorously in Northland, which can be challenging, but the region has few frosts. Another of its advantages is that the fruit ripens very early. In some parts, nets go on before Christmas, and the harvest finishes in mid-March, before some other regions around New Zealand even start. Rod says Chardonnay and Pinot Gris grow well in the north, as do red varieties with thicker skins. Pinot Noir grapes would be prone to splitting.
Every other red varietal would probably do well here on a different site. So some of the varieties that perhaps you couldn't ripen in central Otago, we certainly have enough growing heat and sunlight hours to do those. So probably just about every other red varietal. And there'll be some varieties that we haven't planted yet that are going to be very successful. So that's the excitement, that's the thing that keeps you going.
Yeah, we're about to expand our vineyard by another 4 hectares or so, and a lot of discussions going on now about exactly what the red grape should be in there. It will not just be Syrah and Cabernet Franc, that's for sure.
So you can have a bit of a play.
Oh, well, that's why you do it.
Yeah, when we've got trial blocks of five reds in now, and when we put them in, we knew that we wouldn't keep going with all five of them. And we're just getting to the point now, sort of 4 or 5 years later on those blocks, where we're making the decisions about what stays and what goes.
So the French have been doing it for a long time, so I guess another 100 years we'll know what we're doing.
All right, shall we go and have a look at the winery? Pietro Aloisi and Justin Atkinson are keeping a close eye on this year's wines and on the incoming grapes. You're tasting it?
Well, sometimes you've got to smell them every day because the yeast can produce off flavours and other things, so you've got to keep checking it every morning, and we control the temperatures and things, making sure the fermentation is going well.
So what have you got in your hand now?
This is a rosé.
Have you tasted any so far that look really promising?
Yes, there is some Viognes from Dancing Petrol. They are, as always, tasting quite amazing. We have lots of good Pinot Gris this year. And also the Chardonnay is not too bad, considering all the rain. It's actually came in at quite good flavours.
You've got a lot of different wines in here.
Yeah, we have I think last year we had about 100, maybe 120 different wines.
That came out of this
winery? Out of this winery. So they range in volume from one barrel to maybe 10,000 litres.
When can you tell if a wine looks promising? How early in the process?
As soon as it rolls in the gate, you see the fruit, you can tell it's going to be pretty good.
Do you ever get a wow moment when a load of grapes is delivered and you think, wow, this
yeah,
looks
absolutely.
Good?
Yeah, we've had a few this year, yeah. We've had some Viognier like that and some Syrah, Chambersin, so I'm pretty excited.
I'll let you get on, thank
you. No worries.
Cool.
We had wine away last week, got wine away this week, so we've got fruit coming in and we've got wine going away. So nothing really stops. It's like a big game of chess. So you're moving pieces all the time and you've got to try and plan ahead.
That's such a rich red colour.
It is. It just changes everything. Well, the colours this year are just incredible. We've seen some of the highest sugar rates we've ever seen in 30 years this year. And part of that's getting down to growers doing their jobs properly and site selection.
Can we have a look at this one?
Yep, this is Omata Saraya. These are just going to be fantastic red wines. They're fully ripe, fantastic colour, big tannins, and I couldn't hope for anything more. We were talking before about the 200 years between Marsden planting and what we do now. They couldn't have probably 50, 60 years ago grown grapes that successfully on a big scale here. We didn't have things like netting. We didn't understand the canopy management quite the same. We didn't have the clonal selection. We didn't have the ability to use different sprays. So part of that evolution is the fact that technology's kept up and we can now grow grapes quite successfully here.
At the landing, 9 hectares of grapes grow overlooking Rangihaua Bay, the site of the first Christian mission in New Zealand. The vines sit within a 400-hectare gated estate, with wetlands, native bush, a working farm, and luxury accommodation that has hosted Barack Obama and Mick Jagger. The scenery is just breathtaking, really, isn't it?
It's a very, very nice office, that's for sure.
So on our way out here, I didn't see any signs at all for the landing.
No, we try and keep a relatively discreet profile. All of our visits here to the winery are by appointment only. The road is long and it's dusty and it's dead end, and we're pretty much at the end of it. And so what we do is we will have tastings where we pick people up by one of our private boats, and we'll pick them up from Paihia, Waitangi or Russell. We bring them here to our jetty, give them a tour through the vineyard, and then up here to the winery in the tasting room for lunch.
So they're really appealing to that high end, aren't you?
Yeah, absolutely, and unashamedly. I think that's the future of small producers like us. If we can't do Rod's model, where Marsden Estate sell most of their wine, doesn't leave the property. It's all made and drunk on the at the winery restaurant. The only other way is really to go for the high end experience. There's no future chasing the budget market here.
Peter says the Landing's wines are retailing for about $50 US a bottle in the States, more in a restaurant.
We're getting similar in US dollars over there than we're getting to in Kiwi dollars here. It's definitely more lucrative. There's obviously freight and logistics issues getting it over there, and there's some duties to pay there, but means we don't have to pay excise tax here. So for us, it's absolutely the future, particularly as we bring all these other plantings on. And the New Zealand market is, you know, it's really competitive. And so if we can just get a small portion of a massive market in the States, it makes a big impact on our production and our inventory levels. Rod was definitely underselling himself earlier today, because without Rod McIver over the last 10 or 15 years, there probably wouldn't be a wine industry in Northland. We talked earlier about Okahu Estate up in Kaitaia and Longview down in Whangarei. They have been slowly getting towards the end of their vineyard lives as the owners have been getting older. And so there was nobody else making wine in this mid-north area and around the Kerikeri Bay of Islands area. And that is where we've found most of the vineyards are popping up. So while they're stretched from Kaitaia to Mangawai, the biggest concentration is around the Bay of Islands. So what Rod's done is he's really encouraged and mentored and enabled all of us, ourselves included, to plant grapes, to make wine, and to go on to bigger and brighter things. And so when we took our winemaking away from Rod and into our own winery here, he was incredibly supportive of that. So it's not competition. He just loved to see it growing, the industry in Northland. So he is, as I say, without Rod, we wouldn't be having this conversation at all.
What do you think the Northland wine industry is going to look like in 10 or 15 years' time?
Well, we started off producing around about 40 tonne. Our biggest vintage is 150, and I'd say within the next 2 to 3 years, we'll be doing close to 250 to 300 tonne. And as Peter just said, the production at the landing is going to increase. So I can only see the Northland wine industry becoming a more public part of the New Zealand wine industry in the years to come, with some very successful wines.
And you reckon the rest of New Zealand should get up here and try some, I would imagine?
I'd say the rest of the world should do that.
Rod McIver ending that report. And you also heard from Monty Knight, who owns Okahu Estate, and The Landing's Peter Jones. The Landing's been trialling Malbec, Merlot, Sangiovese, Cabernet Franc and Montepulciano. Well, that's it for this week. Don't forget, our webpage has photos and more stories, and you can subscribe to our podcast there too. Now, you can email us with your feedback or story ideas at country@rnz.co.nz or send a text to 2101. Have a great weekend.
Until next week. Bye.
Bye now.